Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 17th of February, these are our main stories. There are fears that the coronavirus outbreak could push Japan into recession. In China, the Communist Party considers postponing its biggest annual event, the National People's Congress. And the Indian Supreme Court has ruled that women are eligible to get commanding roles in the army, dismissing the government's opposition to it. Also in this podcast, President Emmanuel Macron's plans to change the French pension system are presented to the National Assembly, and the Indonesian teenager visiting death row to meet the bombers who killed her mother.
I would always ask my dad when I was little, "Where is my mom?" I was waiting and hoping for my mom to come home, but she has never come home.
There are fears that the spread of the coronavirus could tip Japan into recession after the latest figures showed its economy shrank at its fastest rate since 2014. Those results cover the 3 months to December before the outbreak began and were affected by a sales tax increase and a powerful typhoon. Analysts are concerned travel restrictions, which have led to a sharp drop in tourism from China, will cause Japan's economy to contract further. Sarah Toms is in our Asia business unit in Singapore.
These figures come before we've even seen what kind of impact the coronavirus is having on the economy. And the deadly virus has brought businesses in China to a virtual standstill. And it's also led to a big drop in those lucrative Chinese tourists visiting Japan. And it's no surprise, really, that analysts are now getting jittery that the world's third largest economy could face recession soon. And Japan's particularly vulnerable, as China is its largest trading partner and its biggest source of visitors.
Japan has the biggest cluster of infections outside China on the Diamond Princess cruise ship, where the health ministry has confirmed the total number of people infected has risen to over 450. Two chartered planes carrying hundreds of US citizens evacuated from the ship have landed back in the US. The CBS News correspondent, Deborah Alfarone, explains what will happen to the passengers now.
They will have to be quarantined for up to 14 days on military bases. But there's a catch to that, because what happened was they were testing people every couple of days when they were on the cruise ship. And some people who did not test positive for coronavirus actually did test positive once they got on that plane, or once they were about to get on that plane. And that number is 14 people. Now, they were kept apart from other people, and they too are now here in the U.S., and they will have to be taken off military bases and, of course, get medical care and be quarantined as well. Right now in the United States, we have 15 confirmed cases of coronavirus. But as I just said, we have 14 more now, so we nearly doubled that overnight.
And in China itself, the biggest event of the political calendar, the Communist Party's National People's Congress, could be postponed as the country struggles to deal with the outbreak of the coronavirus. The number of people infected in China has passed 70,000, with almost 1,800 deaths. Our correspondent Nick Beek is in Hong Kong, and he told us what the potential postponement of the event would mean.
It would be a significant break with tradition in a country where tradition means so much, because this is something that's basically the star event in the political calendar in China. It's been held in March every year for the past 35 years, and it's the coming together of nearly 3,000 delegates in the political system, and basically it's a rubber stamping of everything the Communist Party wants to do. It's something that you'd see on state TV. It's something that happens every year, and for this to be moved would be pretty seismic, really, but we're getting all the indications that it will be, because we heard a senior official saying that it's important that all these delegates are actually on the front line dealing with the coronavirus outbreak in their particular part of the country. There's a meeting next week to sort of say whether this would definitely happen, but all the signs we're getting will be that it will be postponed.
And what's happening with the rate of infection? Are cases still rising?
Well, I mean, once again, we're completely reliant on the authorities in China. They are saying that outside Hubei province, the epicentre, for nearly 2 weeks now, the number of new cases has been falling. However, inside Hubei province, it's quite a, you know, it's a relatively smaller number, smaller numbers to look at. But the last few days may give some hope. I say hope because still 100 deaths were reported in Hubei province yesterday. That's slightly down on the figures we had over the weekend. But clearly they're still fighting a huge battle. And there's been footage on social media that shows one hospital in particular in Wuhan, the main city in Hubei province, where people are being treated in corridors. It's really, really busy in there. It looks like it's a health system which is really struggling to cope.
That was Nick Beek. Now, as you will know, we are planning a coronavirus special edition of the Global News podcast, and we are already getting questions. But if you haven't sent yours in yet on anything coronavirus related, just record it and send it by email to the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and we'll see if our expert panel can provide the answer for you. India's Supreme Court has ruled that all women serving in the army are eligible for permanent commissions, which allows them to get commanding roles. The ruling means women will now be on an equal footing with men when it comes to promotions, ranks, benefits and pensions. However, women are still not allowed in combat roles, and the court order today does not change that. From Mumbai, the BBC's India correspondent Yogita Limaye reports.
So far, most women inducted into the army were only allowed to serve for a maximum of 14 years and didn't qualify to become permanent officers. While the government had announced its intention to change this in 2019, it was not extended to all sections of the army. Monday's Supreme Court order means that all women serving in the forces will now become eligible for a permanent commission. The judges have also ruled that female officers can be given command roles. The government had opposed this move, saying Indian troops are not yet mentally schooled to accept women officers in command, given the rural backgrounds they often come from and social norms in the country. A group of women from the army celebrated outside the courtroom, saying the ruling was a giant leap towards equality in the armed forces.
That was Yogita Limaye in Mumbai. To Indonesia now, where a teenager whose mother was killed in a bomb attack on her fifth birthday has met two of the militants involved. The explosion outside the Australian embassy in Jakarta in 2004 killed eight people. 17-year-old Sarah and her family are taking part in the country's de-radicalisation programme, in which the government facilitates such meetings in an attempt to stop future attacks. The BBC's Asia editor, Rebecca Henschke, went along with Sarah to the prison.
Just getting a security check before we go into the jail. How are you feeling, Sarah? My heart's racing, Sarah says.
Sarah's mother was on the back of her husband Iwan's motorbike. Iwan, who lost his eye and the love of his life, was at first filled with the desire for revenge.
Dulu biar dia merasakan penderitaan.
I wanted them to die, but I didn't want them to die quickly. I wanted to see them tortured first, so that they had some idea of the pain their bomb caused.
But now, along with his children, he's about to meet the man found guilty of planning the attack.
Royce is waiting for Iwan. He's sitting in a wheelchair dressed in a red prison uniform. His hands and his legs are handcuffed. He's had a stroke recently.
Sarah manages to ask, why did you do it?
I couldn't refuse. Maybe when you are older you will understand what it's like. I hope you can be patient and that we can pray for each other.
Disappointed and hurt, they head quietly to the next jail to meet Ahmad Hussein. Images of him during the trial showed a defiant man raising his fists and staring angrily at the camera. He's a very different man today. I never wanted to hurt your father, he tells Sarah and Rizky. I'm a greatly flawed human. Sarah finds it easier here to ask her question.
My friends and I were given the wrong education and learning. I wish that my friends and I didn't act before we had really gained knowledge and understood what we were doing.
Sara looks at her hands and then tells her story.
I would always ask my dad when I was little, where is my mom? And he would answer that she was in Allah's house. I said, where is Allah's house? And he said, the mosque. So I ran away and went to the mosque. I was waiting and hoping for my mom to come home, but she has never come home.
Hassan's face clearly is in pain. He closes his eyes and he opens his hands to the sky as if in prayer.
I'm sorry. I can't hold back my tears. I take Sarah like my own child. Please, please forgive me.
Do you believe him when he said, I'm sorry?
Yeah, bisa.
Yes, she says with a huge smile.
I'm smiling now because the questions that I have asked over and over in my heart for years, it's been answered today. So I feel a wave of relief.
17-year-old Sarah, ending that report from Rebecca Henschke for the Crossing Divide series on the BBC. Reports from Burkina Faso say villagers have been fleeing their homes after a deadly attack on a church in the north of the country. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross says this latest attack is part of a worrying pattern.
The authorities in this remote village of Pansi, which is near the border with Niger, they're saying that the gunmen stormed the village when a Sunday service was taking place. Certainly some of those killed were attending that service. It's not clear whether all of the victims were from the church itself, but a number of people were also abducted by what we suspect is a group of Islamist militants that are pretty active in that area. But it's a very dire situation, and the authorities are talking about, you know, people from that village fleeing to surrounding areas to trying to get to anywhere that they feel safe.
You say suspected Islamist militants, but no confirmation of who was behind it.
No confirmation, but we've got a pattern here of attacks by jihadist groups, some linked to Al-Qaeda, some to Islamic State. And just in the last week, there was another attack in the same area where seven people were taken from the home of a Christian pastor, and later five bodies were found. But if you look back over the last month or so, there have been two large attacks in the north of Burkina Faso, leaving more than 60 people dead. And it's clear the situation is just going from bad to worse. We're also hearing a report just in the last few minutes that several soldiers from Burkina Faso have also died as a result of a roadside bomb. And what's happened over the last few days is that out of sheer desperation, they've now started recruiting volunteers. They're giving them 2 weeks training, giving them guns and saying, defend your villages.
So the authorities are completely unable to handle what's going on at the moment with this pattern of attacks.
Well, certainly. I mean, over the last 3 or 4 years, it's just gone from a situation where there was the occasional attack coming across the border from Mali to an appalling situation now where since 2015, it's thought that 750 people have been killed and more than 500,000 displaced in Burkina Faso.
That was Will Ross. Still to come in this podcast, the end of an era in Australia.
Australia, what's your favourite sport?
Football.
Snake.
Pie.
Animal.
Kangaroo.
And what's your favourite car, Australia?
Holden.
Let me see, that's football.
General Motors have announced they will stop making the Australian car brand Holden. We'll have more on that later. Now, as we record this podcast, the French government has just presented its controversial new pensions bill to Parliament. It's the biggest overhaul of the system since the Second World War and the centrepiece of President Macron's programme of reforms. But it's also become the focus for his left-wing opponents, who since December have staged weeks of strikes and demonstrations to try to force the government to back down. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
Après un mois et demi de grève, tous les jours.
Alexis Louvet is a Paris bus driver. I met him in a cafe near his depot in Saint-Denis. He spent much of the last 3 months on strike against the Macron pension reform, and he's out again this week. Of course, Alexei, like other metro and train drivers, is used to the criticism that he's only doing it for himself. In the current system, he has a special status. He can retire early at 57. But he insists that's not what he's trying to protect.
When you do the calculations, you can see that the main result of this reform would be to lower the level of people's pensions. Today there are many pensioners here in France living in a state of absolute misery, and this law would make things even worse. It's not acceptable.
Since December, France has been in ferment over pensions. The government's plan is to introduce a uniform point-based system, ending the multitude of different regime and privileges that exist today, and also encouraging people to work till later in life so that the system becomes financially sustainable. But for the left-wing opposition, pension reform has become a rallying cry, and they're doing everything they can to derail it. Here in Parliament, where the bill was until last week going through the committee stage, the far left tabled a record 20,000 amendments. And on the street, the weekly strikes and demonstrations go on. Roland Lescure, a Macronite MP who heads the Assembly's Economic Affairs Committee, says it's time for the protesters to let up and let the democratic process of lawmaking take over.
There's fewer of them, but they're pretty determined. And I think their main enemy is maybe Emmanuel Macron, the president, but also there's a bit of an insurrectional flavor to those demonstrations. They're kind of actually questioning the modern democracy as it stands. I mean, we have a major, huge majority here in this parliament, and they're questioning the fact that we could discuss, amend, and vote a law, which at the end of the day is what we paid for.
But the thing about this wave of French protests, it's not really or not just about pensions. When you speak to demonstrators, you quickly realise that their beef is much bigger. Pensions are a catalyst, a focus. Really, it's everything that President Macron stands for that gets them angry.
It's never just the reform, the pension reform. It's also just a general move towards a society that we don't want.
The lesson of this ongoing pension saga? President Macron will presumably get his reform through later this year. His majority in Parliament is decisive. But it's still not a popular reform. Many people are very anxious about what it means for them personally. And for once, the French opposition, in particular the left, seems to have found a cause that works.
Hugh Schofield reporting from Paris. For months, political parties in Portugal have been debating changing the law to legalise euthanasia or assisted dying ahead of a formal vote in Parliament this week. Most deputies are expected to support the proposed reforms, but the Catholic Church opposes any change and is pressing for a nationwide referendum. Alison Roberts reports from Lisbon.
In Porto and Braga cathedrals and many other Roman Catholic congregations across Portugal, clerics appealed for the faithful to oppose moves to legalise assisted suicide days before Parliament is to debate the subject. Five parties have put forward proposals detailing the circumstances under which people with terminal illnesses or in great suffering should be enabled to die. With a majority of deputies expected to vote in favour of reform, the Church last week announced that it would press for a referendum on the subject. Around 80% of the population are self-declared Catholics, but surveys have shown a majority in favour of allowing assisted suicide. Even more, though, say they want a referendum.
Alison Roberts in Lisbon. In Madrid, a Spanish film and television actor, Willy Toledo, is on trial for insulting God on social media. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco, who's in the Spanish capital, told us more.
Well, Willy Toledo, back in 2017, posted a text on his Facebook profile in which he used some very graphic language to express his atheist beliefs. He criticised the Virgin Mary and God in extremely graphic language. I mean, I can't repeat a lot of the things he said on air. And a group called the Spanish Association of Christian Lawyers took particular offence at this and said that he had offended religious sentiment with these comments that he'd posted. And so they have brought this lawsuit against him, which has led to his trial today.
And what will he be using as his defence in this trial?
Well, basically, I'll be using the argument of freedom of speech. There are a lot of people who've come out in his defence saying not necessarily that they agree with what he said and not even that they even like him as a personality. He's a very controversial character. But they say that this is a really key issue of freedom of speech here. Whether or not you agree with what he posted on Facebook, they say he should be allowed to say it and he shouldn't face legal action for posting it. So that's essentially his argument. And his lawyer has said that this is something akin to the Spanish Inquisition of medieval times, the fact that this is even going to court.
And tell us a little bit more about the blasphemy laws that there are in Spain, because this has revived calls for the abolition of them, hasn't it?
Well, yes, it has. And this has been a debate that has been running for some years. This law of offending religious sentiment, which is akin to a sort of blasphemy law, has remained in Spain's penal code, despite the transition to democracy at the end of the 1970s. Now, there have not been many cases of people being found guilty for this. I suppose a comparable case was 2 years ago, in 2018, a man in the south of Spain, in Jaén, was found guilty of offending religious sentiment after he posted a picture of his face and superimposed it on a picture of Jesus wearing a crown of thorns. He ended up paying a fine of just under 500 euros. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but there was a big outcry after that case. And I think this is a debate which is going to run with this trial, which is continuing.
That was Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Loneliness is a problem we often associate with the elderly. But in some countries, including the UK and US, the latest research suggests that young people are even more at risk. It's a big issue in Sweden too, where it's common to live alone as soon as you leave school. More than half of all homes have just one occupant. But the southern Swedish city of Helsingborg is testing a different kind of living, as Maddie Savage reports.
Here we go.
Enter the palace.
Dragana Kurovic works for a city council housing company that's running a new experiment called Sällbo. That's a mix of the Swedish words for companionship, sällskap, and bo, living. It's an apartment block for 72 tenants. Around half are pensioners and the rest are under 25. And they have to promise to spend 2 hours a week together.
We wanted the elderly to feel less lonely by mixing them with younger people who are included in the society.
Once the company started talking to younger tenants for their research, they realised how much it could help them too. 8 out of 10 Swedes aged 18 to 34 often or sometimes experience loneliness, which can be as bad for our health as smoking or drinking. In Sweden, it's common to live alone as soon as you leave school, and there are concerns that the rise in social media use and gaming has increased social isolation.
My name is Vesa Eriot. I'm 20 years old.
I was kind of lonely when I was living alone. I worked, went home, went to game. Here I'm kind of forced to go around and meet people, and my mood is quite better.
The Sällbo building is a former retirement home, and the communal lounges here have been revamped into spaces specifically designed to encourage offline socialising. There's an arts and crafts area, a yoga studio, a library. Fia is on her way to watch her friend Gunnil play cards.
Hey Gunnar.
Who's winning the card game?
Not me.
Gunnil is 86 and struggled with loneliness after her husband died in 2018.
Fia has helped me with my computer and she had driven me to IKEA.
How can you describe how you feel now compared to how you felt when you lived alone? What's the difference?
It's an enormous difference.
Socialising has clearly come naturally to many of the tenants here. But to make sure everyone joins in, the two-hour-a-week rule is written into their rental contracts.
We can't throw them out because they don't socialise. It's more if you sign that you will socialise, even if you are shy, there is an ethic feeling that I have to do something.
The project is not just for people who've grown up in Sweden. A few years ago, the country took in record numbers of refugees, but integration is an ongoing challenge. So 10 of the apartments have been reserved for young immigrants.
That report by Maddie Savage in Sweden. General Motors says it's going to retire the historic Australian car brand Holden as it's no longer competitive. The American car giant will end Holden's sales, design and engineering operations in Australia and New Zealand by next year. Up to 600 jobs will be lost. Our Sydney correspondent Shaima Khalil says Holden has been known as Australia's own car.
Holden is really not just a car manufacturer or a car brand. Holden is part of the Australian identity. This is a car that was homegrown, it was mass-produced, it was by Australians for Australians. And there's a very famous 1970s TV ad with a chorus that says, "We love football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars."
Australia, what's your favourite sport?
Football.
Snack?
Pies.
Animal?
Kangaroo.
And what's your favourite car, Australia?
Holden.
Let me see, that's football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars, huh?
Right.
Well, you sure sound like Australia to me.
We are.
And that really tells you all you need to know about, you know, society's attachment to this car. You know, when the news came out today that Holden was axed by General Motors, the reaction really was visceral. It was not just business reaction or government reaction. It was people posting pictures of themselves on Twitter when they were young with their parents' Holden car, or saying, look, this is me with my first Holden car. And someone tweeted me and saying, look, this is part of our identity. It was encouraged by the media, by the government. We were proud of our manufacturing industries. That's how much it means to Australia.
The Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, he said that he's disappointed but not surprised, but I am angry, like I think many Australians would be.
The reason the government is angry is because apparently we understand that they only found out 15 minutes before the announcement was made. So this was breaking news. The management and the head of General Motors and Holden Cars came out in a big press conference and announced this shocking news that Holden was going to be axed. Apparently the government, the leadership didn't know about that. Remember, Holden has been for decades subsidized and supported heavily by the government. It was only until 2013 when the government of Tony Abbott reduced that kind of support, but it was always seen as a very close relationship between Holden and the government. And the industry minister, for example, she also said that this behavior was unacceptable, that the decent thing to do was to inform the government. So they'd also been taken by surprise, and they felt that Holden did not give them a chance to fully prepare themselves and also, I think, the Australian society for this kind of announcement.
That was Shaima Khalil in Australia. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, or you'd like to send your coronavirus questions or indeed pictures of your Holden car, just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
That's me drinking millions of viruses.
Crowd Science is the podcast that takes your questions and turns them into audio adventures.
My question for Crowd Science is, why and when did humans first start cooking food?
It's all fun!
I'm Marnie Chesterton, and each week we put your questions to scientists working at the limits of human knowledge.
I want to know how do they know what to do?
They're yanking on their neighbours, they're pushing on their neighbours.
We also try and demonstrate exactly what they're telling us.
What are the limits of human endurance?
You've just run a marathon and been hit by a car. How are you?
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
So if you'd like to inject a bit more science into that,
just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I knew it. Amazing.